My name is Yisrael Campbell, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And this is my home group. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary purpose is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be of helpful to your recovery and to your understanding. Rob will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Rob. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Elise will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Elise, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. The 12 steps. One, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Marla will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Marla. I'm an alcoholic. 12 traditions of AA. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Tanya.
Hi, I'm Tanya. I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, AA, this program, the steps as outlined in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, fellowship, sponsorship, I have not had to pick up a drink, or I haven't picked up a drink since May 6, 2002, and for that I'm incredibly grateful, and if you knew me then, you would be grateful too, because I was a crazy lady. This is awesome. AA has been the biggest buzz of my life, the best high of my life, and just seeing all of you out here, I don't know a lot of you, but I do know you, and that's this thing, this connection. That's just awesome. That's hard to put into words. AG, thank you so much. And Debbie, thank you for having me here tonight. I said a little prayer earlier today that my ego would be removed and the fears and wanting to sound good and to be liked and that I could just be of service. And that's what I asked God to help me do this evening. You know, in 10 minutes, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, I drank a lot. I drank and I drank and I drank. And I don't want to talk too much about the war stories. We all have them. But I was thinking this past week of a couple of highlights to just kind of sum it up. And I used to think, oh, the story of Tanya, you know, my story. I was born in Rahway, New Jersey. Yeah, where there's a big prison. And I was born, and if you were born to hippie parents that were 18 and 19 and didn't know what they were doing, and all these things about my story, if you knew my story, and that's why I drank. And actually, what I've come to find out, and it's really helpful to get a sponsor, because I did not understand what alcoholism was or is. I knew I had a really big problem. You know, that alcohol is just a symptom of a much bigger problem, which is mostly my self-centeredness in me, which I had no idea how self-centered I was. So I never felt a part of, right? And I hear a lot of speakers say that I never felt connected. Right? And there was a part of me that liked that, I think. Even getting sober, I was like, I'm unique, I'm different. Let me tell you my story to my sponsor, you know, like, but wait. And this whole process has been a leveling process, realizing that, you know, I'm a worker among workers. I'm an AA among AAs. And that's been very, very cool thing to find out, because it really just takes the pressure out of life and trying to be something. You know, I got to do something with my life. You know, and as I discovered my powerlessness with alcohol and my powerlessness with a lot of things, I actually felt a new sort of power filter in. But so I never felt a part of, and I discovered what alcohol could do for me at the age of 14 when I was starting high school, and two of my best friends decided they didn't want to be friends with me anymore because they were going to be popular and cheerleaders, and I didn't make the cheerleading squad. So I started hanging out what we called back then the burnouts in Edison. And I was at a party. And I wanted to be accepted and feel a part of, and I was drinking Meisterbrau beer, and Pink Floyd, The Wall was on, and I proceeded to get that warm, fuzzy feeling, and I started to feel like a part of this group. That's all I ever wanted to do was feel a part of and connected, and ultimately loved. And things happened that evening that shouldn't happen to any 14-year-old. When I woke up and found out what happened the next day and my parents were involved, I felt the guilt, shame, and remorse that I would continue to feel for many, many years, and that vicious cycle over and over and over again. And I did not see the truth of what alcohol was doing to me. I could only see what it was going to do for me. And that proceeded for 15 years, right? The progression. At 18, I moved into New York City to become famous. And one thing I should say, I was a dancer, a professional dancer, dancer classically trained, for those of you whose minds might be wandering. ballet train. And I got offered a scholarship in New York City with a well-known teacher, so I moved in. And I thought the best way to go about this was to get a job. And my first job, waitressing job, was at the White Horse Tavern. And when I sat down for the interview, they said, you know, Dylan Thomas, a well-known Welsh poet, drank himself to death here. Should have been an ominous warning, right? I thought, cool, this is the place for me. And so on my way to becoming famous and a dancer and a performer, drinks started to take a more important part of my life, and the progression set in, and the White Horse led to after-hours clubs, led to just the lower depths of hell. And it was scary, and I couldn't see a way out. What happened was I thought I'd get married. I married another alcoholic, and I didn't think it could get worse. It did. I got divorced. I didn't think it could get worse. And this is just my story. For 2 years straight, I drank round the clock, 24 hours a day. And I didn't realize that shaking in the morning, I thought it was just being anxious, was the alcohol not being in my body. What happened was I finally thought of something else besides myself, and I said, dear God, kill me or get me help, because I can't live this way. And I was at that crossroads where I didn't know there was an answer, that there was a solution. I found myself, and it wasn't a series of coincidences, I believe it was the grace of God, that got me into an AA program. My mom had been in Al-Anon, you know, she left little big books around all the time. And I sat in a meeting in Hoboken, New Jersey, called Fog Lifters at 7 in the morning, shaking, terrified. I couldn't look up. I had a baseball cap on and sweats on. And the people in that room smiled at me like they're smiling tonight. And they said, welcome. We're so happy you're here. And I thought, oh, God. And these women just smiling and throwing numbers at me. I remember writing down blonde chick I like, you know. Like, I didn't even know who they were. I was just like, she's kind of cool. So what happened was I got even sicker without the alcohol in my body. I moved in with another alcoholic, and we both were living in untreated alcoholism, right? That's really terrifying. And, you know, I was throwing things and I felt like, well, there's no alcohol in me. Now what's the problem? And then I ended up, in a big book workshop, and my life changed forever. And, the late, great Howard G. took me through this book, and his sponsor was Joe of Joe and Charlie, and I got the message very clear. I was ready. I was ready to hear it, and I grasped onto AA, and I did AA really, really hard, and I really annoyed a lot of people. I was just so excited about this book, and I slept with it. Yeah, I still have it. You know, I have my first. I just love this program because it's. I read a lot of spiritual books when I was active, and they'd have like wine stains all over them. Like, where is God? I know there's got to be something else, you know? And this is the only thing I've never tried to mess with. I mean, you know, I had sponsors I didn't want to listen to, for sure. I didn't want to listen because the truth was scary. And the first time I said, hi, I'm Tanya, I'm an alcoholic, I cried. Because it was the beginning of getting truthful. And, you know, you say to thine own self, be true. And it's freeing. And it's to this day, you know, 6.5 years later, I don't like to see the truth, you know? I don't, you know, there's things and relationships that don't happen and things that I want. And I'm like, ugh. But I know that when I let go, the plan is much better than I could possibly imagine. And it's not just for me. I'm not special. I'm not unique. I do what I was told to do, that I hear the people that have the light on and that are smiling and that are living happy, joyous, and free do. Work the steps, work the steps, work the steps. Be of service, be of service. You know, dying of oneself is true living. And for me, every day, that's a battle. I get up every day, and so does my ego and my self-centeredness. And what it's like today, the past 6.5 years have been a trip, man. Fasten your seatbelts. It's a trip. I've got to live in different areas. I've made many friends in this program. I was engaged, and then I was not engaged, and I started a business, and, you know, today was a really good day. there's a page in the book, and I don't like to quote pages and stuff, but page 52, but I will anyway. it talks about, you know, a feeling of uselessness, of not feeling like you had trouble with personal relationships. You know, as the inside started to change, the outside started to change. And that's the miracle, I think, of this program, was because I could not change my thought process about drinking. I couldn't see the truth. I couldn't see the mental obsession I had with it and with a lot of other things. And it's only been through this program, from the women in this program, especially a big thanks to, that taught me how to speak and how to dress and how to live. I'm incredibly grateful for and the sponsorship. I wish you all many days happy, joyous, and free. Thank you so much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Adam.
Hi, I'm Adam, and I'm an alcoholic. Okay, my sobriety date is June 13th, 2006. I am on the ninth step. I'm living in 10, 11, and 12. And my sponsor is Stephanie P., and Atlantic Group is my home. I also have the privilege of sponsoring two amazing men, Stephen and George. And, you know, I just want to say I love AA, and I love my home group. You know, you all saved my life. You know, what I learned here is, you know, in this book, was that I suffer from alcoholism, which is it's a progressive and fatal disease that centers in my thinking. And I need to be sponsored, I need to be doing service, and I need to be working the steps. So I stay away from a drink, because, you know, for me to drink is to die. And you know, I'm just really excited to be here. I'm really nervous. I'll just get that out there. I hear that's God shaking the truth out of me. So, you know, I'm going to start with step one. You know, I'm powerless towards alcohol, and my life became unmanageable. I believe I was powerless from the very start. I remember my first drink. I was 8 years old. I was sick, and my mom came in to me, to my bed, and I was on a waterbed. This was, you know, the late 80s. And she handed me this sifter of brandy, and there was an etched sailboat on it, and it was beautiful. And I remember every second of it, and it was a magical experience for me, and I remember drinking that, and I remember the feeling, and I remember loving the way it made me feel. And, you know, from that point on, I started stealing sips of my father's beer. I started taking white Zinfandel out of the box when my parents weren't home. And it just, you know, it progressed, and I liked the way it made me feel until I found my first friend with a fake ID, and he became my best friend very quickly, and he got me my first, I guess, liter of Southern Comfort, and I drank it really fast. I had a small party, and what I remember from it was that I finally could live in the world that I was presented with. I always felt uncomfortable in the world that I was living, and I finally liked the world that I was in. And, you know, from that day forward, I lived from to the moments that I would have a drink when it was like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then for those moments that I was drinking. That's what I lived for. And, you know, I went to college, I started drinking a lot, and, you know, during this time, I was living with, an alcoholic mother. You know, it was very mommy dearest, you know, a lot of passing out, a lot of screaming at each other, and me calling the cops because I thought she was dead, and, you know, she ended up in rehab institution, you know, home confinement for 2 years, then jail for a year, jails. And then she died when I was 19 in an accident to her head. And I had to take her off life support after 24 hours because I was her only heir. Seeing that, you know, self-knowledge availed me nothing. I used that to empower me. I felt entitled, so I drank more. I went off to college. I started drinking daily. And I got pulled over for a DUI and decided that I needed to move to New York City because driving was my problem. And so I did, and I got here, and I could drink the way I really wanted to drink. I, you know, bars were open until 4 o'clock in the morning, and you know, what my drinking looked like was, you know, it started off that I would, you know, I would either have a few drinks, or I would get drunk and I would black out or pass out. You know, those are my options. I didn't know what was going to happen, but that's how it started. You know, and at the end, what it looked like is I would either pass out or black out, which was the good option. And then the other option was that I would disappear for 3 days. And, you know, I worried a lot of people. I destroyed a lot of relationships. I estranged my family, just like my mother did. And I didn't identify with that at all. I didn't see my part in anything. And, you know, at the end of it, I ended up in the hospital twice for, you know, drinking related activities. I walked out into the middle of traffic and I got hit by a taxi. And I went home. I didn't know how to take care of myself. I went home and I woke up and I couldn't walk. I had a meniscus tear in my left knee. But I went to work. And eventually they sent me to the emergency room. That's what you do. But I didn't know. I didn't get it. Things were getting really bad. And I remember, in February of 2006 or March, I was sleeping and I had a vision. And the vision was that, in April, when my birthday is, my mom came back to me, you know, after 8 years and she was sober. And it was the first time I had ever seen anybody sober. And, she had tried AA and it didn't work for her. And, I woke up and something had changed in me and I knew that recovery was possible. And, you know, in June of that year, I ended up from a friend of a friend, really odd coincidences. I found out she was going to this, you know, fantastic meeting in the Upper East Side and there was like beautiful people there. And I was desperate and I latched on. I came here and I met all of you people. This was my first meeting on a Tuesday night and I was scared and I sat here and I heard the message. I heard the solution and I went to walk out the door and I was stopped by a man and he said, "Do you want to sponsor? Are you willing to go to any lengths?" And I said, "Yeah, okay." And I went to walk out and he said, "You know, your life doesn't have to be like this anymore." And I knew that he knew what he was talking about. Like, it's like he looked into me and he just knew what my life was like this entire time, how painful it was. And for the first time, I said yes to something for myself. And I went home and like many times I would have that bottle, I would dump down my mom's bottle down the drain until I started stealing it. Then I went home and I had a bottle of like $3 wine and I went and I poured it down the drain. You know, and that's the, you know, the last time that I've ever, you know, had alcohol. And, you know, from that point forward, I haven't, you know, had the need to pick up. And, you know, it says in the big book, it says, you know, when the idea of, you know, the true nature of one's disease is implanted in the, you know, the mind of another, you know, that's how we recover. And I, you know, it just wasn't the same anymore. And, you know, when I got to the second and third step, it was like, you know, find a higher power. And I was like, you know, you want me to put my life into the hands of something that, you know, I can't see, hear, touch, feel. And it was, and I, you know, I was one of those agnostics. I thought I was atheist. I was, you know, I thought I was like punk rock, like Nine Inch Nails, Tori Amos, and all that growing up. And I looked at myself and I was like, and I was taking my contacts out at night. I was brushing my teeth. I was cleaning my room. I got an HIV test. I was going to the doctor, you know, after a few months being here. And I was like, I thought to myself, you know, you haven't been able to take care of yourself for 27 years. You know, what makes you think that you're doing this now? And, you know, it was like, I became willing at that point to just move on. And like when I did my third step prayer, you know, when you find somebody with a fake ID and, they're going to get you that alcohol and you know everything's going to be all right. Like, that's that feeling I got when I did the third step because I just knew everything was going to be all right. You know, I was going to get my fix, you know, and it's been ups and downs. I took an inventory, you know, in 4 through 7 and, you know, asked God to remove my character defects, started to see my part in a lot of things and, started to see where, you know, where I was like my mother. And, you know, I had, you know, I've had beautiful, amazing things that had happened to me since I've come to the program. And, you know, one of that has been, you know, making amends. And, you know, I had wondered how I was going to make amends to my mother, you know, after, you know, she'd passed away. Thank you. And, you know, my sponsor, you know, took me to Pockets of Enthusiasm and was like, you're going to apologize to her on the beach because the beach was her favorite place. And I apologized to her. And I felt stupid. And then the next thing I did was I found the man, the name of the man who sang Ave Maria at her funeral. And I found out that the tree that was planted in at her memorial, because I didn't care about those things before. I was so cut off from my feelings and from the world. And then what I did in July 2007 was I visited my mom's grave for the first time in 9 years. So something was wrong, and you know, something just wedged loose when I got there, and I cried for the first time for her, you know, for her life, and I was able to bury my 1 year coin there, and then I returned, you know, this past July, and I buried my 2 year coin, and thank you, and you know, I love all of you. Thank you so much for giving me my life back.
Good evening, Atlantic Group. I'm so glad to be here. I was here once before, and it was such a great experience that when Heidi called me to ask me to come back, I said, yeah. It's a beautiful church. I have great admiration for the group and the way you guys operate. It reminds me of the old time sobriety, you know. Looking good when you come out here, you know, looking good when you celebrate. You know, my sponsor told me in the beginning that I couldn't carry the message looking like the devil, you know, and I always remember that. You know, I am an alcoholic, and my name is Carolyn. And an old friend of mine that I've had in the program just not very long ago, said, Carolyn, why do you say I'm an alcoholic first and that your name is Carolyn? And I said, because the last drying out place that I was at, they told me I better remember what I was first and never mind what my name was. And I got in that habit. So I am an alcoholic first and foremost. It really doesn't matter what my name is, because if I forget who I am, I'm in trouble. I was born and brought up in Kentucky. And that's kind of foreign to, New York. In fact, I notice sometimes these, weathermen never tell you what the weather is in Kentucky. They just bypass it like it doesn't exist. You know, and I've been meaning to call somebody up and let them know that. But I didn't know that Kentucky didn't matter to New York, you know, when I was growing up. And I grew up in a very a strict Catholic home. And in those days, Catholicism in Kentucky was a rarity. You know, they didn't even bus me to school because I was Catholic. That my mother, if we were going to get a ride to school with my mother, she had to take us or we had to ride the city bus. And those were in the days where, you know, I was not supposed to really, get involved with a Baptist, you know. My dad was very strict. When I was 10 days old, my dad and I were baptized together. He was baptized into Catholicism. And he took to Catholicism like we do when we come here and we're as desperate as the dying can be and we grab onto AA. And he was a very devout man. He was a very honest man. He practiced what he preached. And he made daggone sure that his kids did the same thing. And so I went to Catholic school And you know, when I was a little girl, my dad used to do the USO thing. He played the guitar, and they used to stand me on a card table, and I would sing. And I would sing songs like, "If You Let Me Be Your Little Sweetheart, I'll Be Much Obliged to You." And that's kind of the way that I grew up relating to men. If you'll let me be your little sweetheart, I'll be much obliged to you. And, you know, I look back on those times with a lot of nice memories. And we'd go down to the farm where my mom grew up, and on a Sunday afternoon, my dad played the guitar, my uncles would play the fiddle, and my grandpa would play the jew's harp. And those were fun times. But, you know, life goes on, and you grow up. And I didn't pick up my first drink until I was about 18 years old. And the first drink that I had was a Pink Lady. And I was very much a lady at that time. And that was not the way I ended up. I loved the pretty glass. I loved the pretty drinks. And I had this romantic notion about drinking. And in the 50s, when I was doing some of this stuff, you know, we'd go to these supper clubs and they'd have bands and you'd order, you know, the nice dinner and you'd dance. And I don't remember having a really big problem at that particular time. And then, you know, we'd go to the races and we'd get all gussied up and we'd wear our hats and the white gloves and I'd come home, you know, having had a few drinks and lay down and take a rest, do nothing else but get up, shower, although we didn't have a shower then. We only had a bathtub. And people laugh at me because I still want to wash my hair in the sink. And they say, "Why do you want to do that?" And I said, "Because we didn't have a shower in our house till much later, you know." But anyway, you know, my Uncle Joe used to come to the house with a pint in his back pocket. This was my mother's. He was my great uncle, my mother's uncle. And every time Uncle Joe showed up, there was going to be a problem because my mother was going to get lit and my dad was going to be upset. And so that's how I started associating, you know, that my mother was going to get drunk or have too many drinks and that would upset my dad, you know. But I was definitely predisposed to the disease of alcoholism. There was, you know, alcoholism on both sides of the family, even though my father probably wouldn't admit it if he was alive today. But he had brothers who had a problem, and I had uncles and an aunt, and my mother. She was not a daily drinker, but when she drank, you know, she could not probably guarantee her behavior. But I didn't drink alcoholically right away, and yet I have to tell you that when I did drink, that, you know, I would do things, silly things like, you know, pick a fight with my boyfriend over some girl he looked at, or, you know, and then it got a little more serious where if I didn't get my way, I would threaten to jump out of a moving car, you know, things like that. And so when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, my life was a mess because my will was to drink and have my own way. And when this plane went down the other day in the Hudson River, I fondly remembered what this guy told me at one of the drying out places where I was. And I was having a real problem because I was hitting drying out places like they were, you know, going out of style. And this guy said to me, he said, "Carolyn," he says, "you know what your problem is?" He said, "If you were on a shipwreck and they offered you a white, whatever you call them, he say, "Oh no, I don't want that one. I want the blue one." You know, the point is that no matter what anybody offered me, I was never satisfied. You know, so, you know, life went on. I'd much rather have danced than drank. I left many a drink on the table because I really liked to boogie. And I still do. I mean, really. Music is, you know, just can change my mood, was my everything. I took piano lessons and I really excelled in the state contest, and I used to get superior all the time. And they told me I had a very bright future, and I had much potential. And when I was in high school, a situation happened that shook my world. And it shook my family up. The clergy was brought in, and there was much shame and guilt that I carried for many, many years. And I drank to run away from it. Only I didn't know that I was doing that. And along came this big spender from the east. It's kind of swept me off my feet. And I don't know what was wrong with me, except I had the disease of alcoholism. I was uninformed, incapable of making healthy decisions. And I met this guy, and he was telling me how wonderful I was and what he could do for me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I started going out with him in January and April. I had an engagement ring on my finger, and in June I was married. And I didn't know what had hit me. You know, the criteria that I picked him, he had a 1958 brand new Chevrolet Impala, and it was blue, just like his eyes, you know. And that's how much I knew about picking a life's partner, you know. I look back on that and I say, whoa, did you need your head examined? You know, because I didn't have to get married, you know. So we got married and I had a really nice job with a big corporation with much potential. And I worked very hard and I liked it. And my husband loved that I had this great job. And I got pregnant right away. 9 months and 3 weeks after we were married, I had a little boy. And I look back on that now, and I was no more equipped to be a mom, no more equipped to be a wife than the man in the moon. And we didn't drink a lot. There just wasn't much opportunity for us to drink a lot. But we moved to New York, and we got in with this rather wealthy crowd. And after Mass on Sunday, my husband wasn't Catholic, but after Mass on Sunday, we'd gang up and go to somebody's house and have whiskey sours. And I didn't realize right away that I was in the grips of a progressive illness. But I can tell you this, when my daughter was 11 months old, I got pregnant right away again. And when my daughter was 11 months old and I was sitting there feeding her, and this was after some physical abuse started, I realized that I had made a terrible mistake. And I believe that's where I crossed over that invisible line. You know, down deep inside, I was Catholic. My father was the pillar of the church. I was going to get disowned if I got a divorce. There was no way out for me, and the fear was tremendous. And so I kept hanging in there, okay? And we would go out and we'd drink, and I'd have somebody tell me, oh, Carolyn, you've got the greatest personality, and you dance so good. And it was because I'd had a couple of drinks. And so I figured, you know, that part in Bill's story, where that feeling of grandeur, you know, I identify a lot with that. I identified with the speakers tonight. And it's real important that I identify with the speakers, because if I'm not identifying and I'm comparing, then I'm in trouble. And I don't care how much time we have. But anyway, to make a long story short, I call AA this day, and I said, please send me some literature in an unmarked envelope, you know, and I got the envelope and opened it up and I gave it a quick glance and shoved that thing in a drawer. I said, I'm not that bad, you know. And life went on. We drank a lot in one of the ways that I was able to deny even more and, you know, be okay about it was that the whole crowd we hung out with drank just like I did. Just like I did. And my husband, I used to go get him and bring him home. You know, he had a problem too, although I was not too aware of it because I was always worried about where I was going to get my drink. You know, this marriage went from bad to worse. And I decided to go to a parish priest for some counseling because I wanted to save this marriage on account of the kids. And now by this time, I'd had three. And this priest was very nice to me, and he was very good. And he said, you know, at the end of the 6 months, he said, Carolyn, he said, I can't guarantee you that this marriage is going to be saved. He said, in fact, he says, I would tell you to get out of it while you're still alive. You know, and I, of course, you know, if you don't have an open mind, you don't hear what's being said. But he did say, no matter what happens, he says, I have to tell you that you have a drinking problem and you should go to AA. And the hair went up on the back of my head, and I had been seeing a psychiatrist because I was trying to pull it all together, you know. And I started having some physical problems. You know, I would go to the grocery store, and I would have these dry heaves. You know, then I ended up in the hospital with a stomach condition. I would be walking across the kitchen floor, and I would projectile vomit. And this was all of me being scared to death. And also, you know, that guilt and that shame that we can have. I don't want to bore you with all the details of this very sick marriage, but in 1972, after the priest and a medical doctor and a psychiatrist told me that I should get out of this situation because it was not very healthy for me, I couldn't get sober. I would go to AA The only thing I can tell you is one night I was walking out the door to go to an AA meeting, and I had had Swiss steak for dinner that night. And my husband just got up from the table, and he says, you're not going anywhere. And he poured the Swiss steak all over me, and I had a brand new white leather coat. And poor me, poor me, poor me. And that would make me, you know, every time something happened like that, that would give me a reason to drink. Every time I would get knocked around, it would give me a reason to drink. Okay, so to make a long story short, I had to leave, and I left the three children with my husband because it was important in my mind, in my sick mind, that these three children stay together. And I would love to say that I got sober right after that, but I was unprotected now. And when I say unprotected, when you live in a house, no matter how unhealthy it is, it somehow protects you from the outside world. And many things started to happen. You know, I the drying out places did not stop. They increased. And I got picked up for drunken driving, and I ended up in jail. And I was dressed to the nines. Dressed to the nines. And I was giving them a hard time, and I dried out at this one place, and I had to find a caretaker because I had nobody to take care of me. I so identified with Adam and Tanya because of the trouble that they had. But to make a long, 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 long story short, with the same old stuff, you know, like I'd pick up that first drink and I'd get drunk. I ended up in AA, and I came in the back door. And I said, oh, am I in the right place? And they assured me that I was. And the first time that they had me speak, I said something like, my name is alcoholic, and I am a Carolyn, or, you know, and I was no more with the program than the man in the moon. But in those days, you know, we are so lucky here because we have so many meetings, so many step meetings, so many big book meetings. We've got, we've got so much going on as far as program goes, and that wasn't always the case back in the early 70s, especially up in Dutchess County where I lived, you know, but I came to the end of the road, and I noticed something in the big book today because I do read it very frequently. Until we let go of our old ideas, the results are nil. Until we let go, absolutely. And I have to honestly tell you that when I let go, absolutely, when I was in my last drying out place, and I woke up, and I came to, actually, and I asked God to please help me. And that was June the 11th, 1974. And from that point on, I have gotten everything I needed to stay sober. I got a sponsor. I got a group. And I had a sponsor who would not listen to me, wouldn't listen about this man that knocked me around the block. "That's just too bad," she'd say. "Don't drink and go to meetings. Call me every morning, ask God for help to keep you sober, thank him at night, and read the 24-hour book," and I called her every day. This big corporation that I had worked for, I got back with some manipulation and getting my own way. And I had picked up a drink my landlady now, at this point, my kids are with my husband, I'm out on my own, which is dangerous. They came this one day, and the head of personnel walked in, and there I was in this rainbow-colored turtleneck, pantyhose, and my hair was clear down to here, and I was skinny as a rail. And she looked at me, and she said, "You're fired." I just looked up at her in a drunken state, and I said, "You're an equal opportunity employer. You're going to hear from my lawyer." You know, the gall of me. And I had this really nice boss that I had called, and he said, "Stop." He said, "If you're an alcoholic," I finally got honest. And he said, "If you're an alcoholic," he said, "stay there, get well. I'll stop your dismissal papers." And that's another instance of God leaving me what I needed. You know, I was not very happy about being an alcoholic, and I was not very happy about having to come to AA, even in the state that I was in. And I had this woman who loved me unconditionally. You know, she got me involved with the solution of the program, which are the steps, you know. And for me to concede to my innermost self that I had this disease was the biggest thing that I've ever done in my life, okay? For me to make a decision to turn my life, my will over to something, I turned my life, my will over to her because I was so scared that I was going to make an unhealthy decision and I would drink again. And at the end of my first year, over the Memorial holiday, I had, you know, my sponsor was very big on the physical part of the disease. You had to eat. You had to, you know, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. She used to pound that in my head. So she had me go for a physical, and one of my tests didn't come back real good. And so, in fact, it was cancer, after my first year, I had to have major surgery. And the only thing I was worried about was staying sober, that I wouldn't get hooked on any pills. And my sponsor was with me all the way. I'm sure a lot of people in this room, what I heard from Barack Obama today was practicing principles, you know, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and let's get going again. Okay? And how many times have all of us done that? And I've done it over and over and over again in AA. Because even though I haven't had a drink in almost 35 years, 34 and something, I still have a lot of work to do on myself. I honestly believe that this disease takes constant vigilance. And I don't mean that in I'm talking about my experience. I can't forget where I came from. Or I have to be aware that I still have character defects, that I have to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. You know, that self-centered fear that we all can get, that I have. You know, and that coming here tonight, I told Max when he picked me up, thank Max so much he's just such a gentleman, and I'm so grateful that he's in my life, and we're in the same group, and I gotta tell you this. Last year I was diagnosed with lung cancer at the end of November, and so when Max found out, I said, Max, I'm not gonna die. You can't have that first slot in June, you know, because we share the same month, and he's always kidding me. I want to be first in June, you know. And I said, oh, no, I'm not going anywhere. And I want to tell you the love and support that I have received from not only Max, but every member of the group and AA in general through that sickness, through many sad times, you know. I had a significant other that I loved dearly that passed away and about, you know, 4 years ago, and my mother passed away 3 months. And, you know, I never thought that my life would be manageable again. I never thought that I would be able to make amends to my children. You know, the harm that was done to them, they didn't have a fair shot. And Max and I were talking about one of my sons on the way down here. I have one son who does not talk to me. You know, I've come to believe too that you can't have an effective relationship with somebody who has the attitudes of the disease of alcoholism or is active in their drinking. And that has been the case somewhat with my children. But this program has given me the ability to be okay with me, okay? To have peace of mind. Peace of mind that money can't buy. You know, and when I do my prayers and meditation, which I do every day. And does that mean I work a perfect program? Absolutely not. But I do know that love and service keep me out of myself. The only problem I've got is the bondage of self. If I'm not thinking about myself, that's a great day. You know, and I love, I have some young women or women, some of them aren't so young anymore, that, you know, and I'm the old lady of the group. You know, and that's okay. To be able to give away, and my sponsor used to tell me, your experience is going to become your greatest asset, and I wanted to smack her. Because what woman does what, you know, in the 70s when I was divorced and I lost my children, and had to give up the custody to my husband, that was a terrible thing. I mean, that was a shameful thing, you know, and I was able to help I have been able to help some other women that have had similar things like that happen. You know what I believe that probably my life is not a whole lot of my business. God kind of just scoots me along, okay? I think there's a power in this room tonight. With all of us, I think God is within each and every one of us, and that if I am, remember where I came from and I'm grateful for what I have, I want to carry it. I want to carry it out. I want to give it away. And that's why I was so impressed today, because I really thought Barack Obama was talking our talk. You know? And if he walks our walk, he was talking principles and the we of the us and the we of the program. None of us would be able to do any of this if it wasn't for the power greater than ourselves, the we of us all, You know, we'd never be able to do it by ourselves or stay sober by ourselves. We have a great group in Westchester. You all should come up and visit us. In fact, Vince has, and Eddie has, and Heidi has. And I would like to thank Heidi for asking me tonight, giving me the honor to be able to share my experience, strength and hope with everybody, because this program has given me life. You know, I came in here having no hope at all, and I was given, have been given, each day. You know, when the count was going on, I wanted to get up here and say, you know, I got one day today because I didn't have to drink today. You know, I didn't even think about drinking today. I thought about coming down here to this wonderful group. And it's so warm, and you all are so welcoming. And I'm just very grateful to be here and glad to be sober. And it's only by the grace of God because, you know, if I'd been left to my own devices, I would not be here today. I did anything and everything to do myself in, and I was not allowed to do that. You know, that's why I know someone, a power greater than me was watching over me. And I didn't realize that right away. And when my sponsor told me about a spiritual awakening, and now the way I've got it kind of in my head is my mother said to me, you know, you can't be a beacon if your light don't shine. And it's true. And the way our light shines is because we keep maintaining our spiritual awakening by working the steps. And I don't know about anybody else, but when I walk in my group and I see those people, everybody in my group, I just feel differently. You know, I can be in the bondage of self that day and walk in, and it goes just like that. Thank you all for listening.